History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. They don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. Our goal here has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we're educated, we're entertained, and we really do find ourselves inspired by the stories we get to hear from our greatest generation. Usually, the voices we're listening to are theirs, World War II veterans, now either nearing the century mark or having already surpassed it. We've met them all over the country over the last couple of decades, but along the way, I've also had the privilege of connecting with some of the folks dedicating their lives to preserving that kind of history. Sarah Vladek did that years ago when she produced an incredible documentary on the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. A New York Times bestseller followed, and today we get to hear about her new release that uncovers some of World War II's hidden history. It'll hit the shelves March the 10th, but you can pre-order now at Amazon.com or other platforms. We also have it linked for you at HometownHeroesRadio.com, where you'll even find a short video of Sarah discussing this long-researched masterpiece. So, Sarah, I'm trying to figure out where to begin here because I know the book The Dangerous Shore has its own origin story. But as far as how a college student ends up spending the next chunk of her life researching World War II, that's not an everyday story. What was the initial spark that led you down this path?
It actually started with a documentary when I was 13. I was watching it with my dad, and it was about World War II and how the war ended. And they summarized the entire war ending with one certain ship, which was USS Indianapolis, being lost after carrying the atomic bomb. And it was reduced to one sentence. So they had this grand, the war ended because of this ship, and it sunk. And I was like, what is this? You know, as a 13-year-old, oh my gosh, what is it? And so that led me to the library because, you know, we didn't have the Google back then. And I couldn't find a lot about it. There weren't books, there weren't movies, there wasn't anything at that time. So I thought, wow, like, you know, what I did learn about it, I wanted to know more. And I thought, well, someone should tell this story someday. I had no idea at the time I would be that person. But I graduated from college, and right after college, I think the next month, I started looking into it again. I said, well, no one's told that story yet. Maybe I can find out more. And by then, Ask Jeeves existed.
And some people are saying, what's Ask Jeeves?
Yes. So pre-Google or AI, the first AI, maybe. I don't know. So I asked, you know, the internet, and found the survivors organization of USS Indianapolis, and they invited me to their first reunion. You know, the funny thing about all this is, like, as a kid in school, I didn't like writing and I didn't like history. I had terrible history teachers. They made it as boring as possible. And so, you know, I just thought that was the only way you learned history, was the way they were teaching it. And then I started learning these stories. I'm like, well, how come I never heard these stories in school? How come I never heard anything about these people? These stories are amazing. And I went to that first reunion, and those were my heroes, the people that I had, you know, had been spending time researching. I was about to meet these, you know, my equivalent of a rock star. And yes, I'm a total nerd, but that's okay.
This audience can understand that, yeah.
But I fell in love with the humanity of the stories, like what these individuals went through. And they were, you could relate to them all. There were everyday people who did what was right when they needed to do it. And for the most part, no questions asked, none of that. And that was what kind of helped me gravitate back toward history and World War II. And it's like, who were the people that fought these wars? You know, school taught me the dates and the places and, you know, ship names and this and that, but they didn't tell me about the men who served on that, or the women who flew the planes, or who were the nurses. They didn't tell me about the people that stayed at the home front and how they helped win the war. So that's kind of what sucked me into this whole history and line of work, I guess you could say, was like the human stories that were tied into the bigger picture.
So for people who don't know, you produced a documentary from those interviews with over 100 survivors of the USS Indianapolis, and they can watch that online, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. Then you write a New York Times bestselling book about the Indianapolis with Lynn Vincent, and I'm sure everyone's seen it in their airport, Indianapolis, in the big giant white letters. And that story's been talked about a lot. But now it sounds like the book that's coming out is a story that really nobody knows. And I'm sure you didn't know until you went down this road. So where did that begin? What was that first little inkling that, hey, with everything that's been written about World War II, there's still an unexplored frontier?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. A friend of mine who was tied into the USS Indianapolis story, he actually was the documentarian who filmed the finding the ship. And so he had been working on another story of a different ship that was on the East Coast. And it was USS Eagle that was a World War I sub chaser. It had been lost in the war, and it was declared to be a boiler explosion. So none of the guys had received any recognition. And every report by every witness said U-boat. But all the Navy records said no boiler explosion. Well, I was asked, like, hey, you know about ships. Why don't you write? This has a lot of similarities to what happened with Indianapolis and the aftermath of Indianapolis with McVeigh and the court martial and what. And so.
And let's spell that out for folks who don't know the story. So that the captain of the ship was court martialed, and it wasn't until decades later, after his suicide, that he's exonerated because of a kid who was even younger than you were when you first got turned on to this. Is there anything else you want to add to that synopsis?
Just that it was, you know, the Navy still considers this one of USS Indianapolis as one of its greatest disasters. But then the tragedy, aside from the 879 lives lost, was the fact that it was covered up and the men felt that they were blamed for the loss. And so it wasn't until 2001 that between the survivors through Hunter Scott, the young boy, and Bill Toedy, that the captain was finally exonerated and his record was cleared. So in the case of now USS Eagle, there was a much smaller crew, but the loss was still kind of blamed on the men. Oh, you didn't keep the boiler up. You know, you didn't do these things. And they were completely ignored. All of a sudden, the testimonies and the naval inquiry disappeared. Turns out the guy that was in charge of the investigation would have been the main person to blame for a U-boat coming that close to our shore without attack or without acknowledging it. So he would have lost his career if he would have said, I'm to blame. So he covered it all up, said boiler explosion, here we are. And the ship had never been found at the time. So when I started this in like late 2019, the ship was still, it had been sunk off the coast of Maine, but no one knew where it was. And there had been multiple attempts. So of course, you know, there's a lot of parallels to USS Indianapolis. And Kirk, who was the one who was filming this and was part of the search for the ship, said, well, hey, you know about this. Why don't you do a book on it? And the Eagle's a really cool story because, you know, like I said, it was built during World War I. And then it was one of the few ships we had when World War II broke out that was ready to fight. We had such a sparse defense, both with, you know, humans and with ships and resources, that we were caught with our pants down when war started. And Eagle was like one of eight ships or something, you know, that was ready to go to defend our shoreline in case the U-boats came. Well, I was like starting to research USS Eagle. And I'm like, this is a great story, but it's not like, there's not enough. There's not enough for it to be its own standalone story. But all of a sudden, these different storylines kept popping up. And each one of them were tied to it in its own way. And next thing I know, I have these eight storylines that are all interwoven. And they all, you know, could kind of be a standalone story. But they are so connected that I thought, well, this would be a really cool way to tell about the Americans on the home front and how really close we were to going to war on our own shore. I mean, it was something like 300 ships sunk within 5 miles of our coastline, and barely anybody knows that. It was both I-boat, which is Japanese submarines, and U-boats, German submarines, that came that close.
And were you aware of that before you started researching this? Did you know it was that significant? Because everyone knows there's a few of them, but I think some people are hearing that. They're saying 300? That's a lot.
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I had always studied the Pacific and that war. And so I knew, you know, obviously about the U-boats. I knew that they were around. I knew that they were kind of lurking off the coasts, and here and there were attacks. I had no idea the magnitude of this. And also on the Gulf, like there was a huge amount of attacks down and through the Gulf waters. And the fact that people would be sitting on the beach, literally sunbathing, and a ship would blow up in front of them. And then, you know, within like an hour, they're walking through the oil that's been washed up. Like, how is this not something we know, you know? And it happened not once, not twice, but a couple hundred times. Like, that's wild. And part of it was censorship, you know, in the sense that they weren't allowed to report this because they didn't want it getting back to the Germans. But the other part of this is like it was just buried. It was not, you know, things like this would be happening, but the war, everyone's eyes were on Europe and Japan and what was happening over there. They weren't actually looking at our own coastline saying, you know, spies are landing here. U-boats are attacking all of our merchants. You know, the losses were huge for all our resources. And had we not turned the tide on that, war would have not only come here, but we wouldn't have had the resources to fight Europe.
Yeah, the implications are pretty staggering. So how do you tell a story like that? How do you start cobbling it together? And what are some of the things that you hope people get when they order The Dangerous Shore?
Well, I think, you know, like I talked about before, the personal stories are what lured me into this, and the personal stories are what carry you through the narrative. So yes, you're learning about U-boats. Yes, you're learning about code breaking and really how the Americans did a lot more than we ever get credit for. You know, the British generally get all the credit, but it was really an American who built and helped design with his team the machine that allowed us to break code. So what I tried to do with this story is really take you through the eyes of those individuals who were pivotal in fighting the war on our shores. And they're everyday people. They're not these, you know, war heroes. They're the super nerdy, half-blind scientists and the, you know, the woman who's a double agent spy and the mafia. I mean, the mafia played a huge part. We had no attacks in New York and we had no union or labor strikes because of the mob. And they worked directly with naval intelligence to do that. So these are the stories that I'm like, oh my gosh, these are so cool. And these are people, I mean, maybe we don't all relate to the mob, but we do relate to, you know, the women who, they weren't allowed to fly. Women were not allowed to fly in combat at that time. And so they would actually pay for their own gasoline and use their own airplanes by selling jam on the side of the road and then using that to fuel and to patrol the shoreline. So these are, you know, regular women. These are regular World War I veterans that are too old to go to war. These are minorities who were not allowed in certain, you know, aspects of combat or the industries. They were the ones that kept that war away. And that's how I told the stories, was getting to know those people through those personal experiences.
And I just have to ask, because it's occurring to me, when you discover what really happened with the USS Eagle, or you start to uncover, well, this unusual suspect made this contribution and this person did this that we would have never known about. Does part of you wonder how many more books like this are out there that we may never know about?
Yeah. I mean, I think about it because a lot of it came from family. So they gave me the personal diaries. They gave me their notes. They gave me, you know, these different aspects, these very personal touches that came from their attics, from basements, from file cabinets. And how many of those have been thrown away? You know, how many of those have been handed over? And, you know, one of the things that in the initial feedback I got from the book and the reviews and such, everyone said, well, these can't possibly, you know, maybe these quotes are fabricated. No, there's literally, like, especially the spy story, they're transcriptions or film reels that the FBI were recording, that there's hundreds of hours and I have all the transcripts. So I'm actually using the real words these people said. These are not fabricated quotes. These are from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So that's, I wonder, like, how much of that is out there, that my book probably would have been 900 pages if they let me put all the stuff in. So there's got to be a director's cut or something like that. But I just wonder how many of those stories, you know, when family members pass away, most of this World War II generation, you know, is gone, or they're going very quickly, and families, you know, they can't keep all the stuff. So they toss what seems to be pieces of paper that mean nothing, but those could be the note that changes what everybody thinks of history.
It's pretty wild to imagine. The possibilities are endless. And it just reminds me of that old quote. I don't know who originated it, but they said, when an old man dies, a library burns to the ground. And your book is evidence of that, and your thought that you just shared. So one thing you do in this book, which I think is really helpful for the reader, is right when I open it up, I see a bunch of faces. And it's almost like the opening credits to an old 80s sitcom or something, right? You're seeing who the characters are in the plot. I really love that literary device that you use there, because now I'm looking at him, I'm saying, okay, I wonder what this person did. I wonder what this person did. Can you think of maybe one example of one of those characters that nobody would ever guess by looking at the picture what the true role or significance was?
It's hard to narrow it down.
You can do more than one if you want. I mean, I don't want to do too many spoiler alerts.
There's a gentleman by the name of Kenneth Knowles. And Knowles was part of what it was called the Phantom Fleet. That was the nickname because they were a fleet without a ship. So they essentially ran logistics, if you will, for the Atlantic. So they were tracking U-boats, and it was like two people, you know. So he is nearsighted. He's been kind of kicked out of the Navy. He's been moved into a journalist position in the reserves, and he gets called up because of his work prior to when they like forced retirement on him. And he ends up being almost like psychic. They would joke like he was psychic because he could track the U-boats so well and knew where they were so our ships could avoid them. But you look at him and he is like the nerdiest nerd of all nerds, you know? And he's got these super bottle, you know, thick glasses. And so, but he changed the war. I mean, when he got involved, essentially, that's when we started winning. You know, so he's working with ultra intelligence. He's now privy to this. He's working with our code breakers, and he's tying all this intelligence together. And that's why there's this, you know, for those who have studied World War II or the Atlantic, there's Black May. And that's kind of for the Germans. That's when everything turned and started going in our favor. It's because of him, and it's because of the people he worked with between, like I said, the code breakers, who Joe Desch is another one who's another nerd and invented what is called the machine, the bomb. And so, you know, things like that where you would never suspect that. Or another one is Harvard Hodgkins, who was a Boy Scout. And because he saw something suspicious in the middle of the night driving home from a church party, it ended up being two spies that landed. And the FBI missed them, the Navy missed them, the Coast Guard missed them. But this kid, Boy Scout, who's like 17 at the time, is what thwarted that whole mission. So those are the kind of people that, you know, you used to open the book up and you see, like, there are a bazillion characters in this book. But really, if you focus on those characters that are shown, the pictures, like you said, you know, the introduction and the preface of the book, those are the people you're following throughout the narrative that really come together in the end of the story.
So what you're telling me is this is a book that nerds are going to love.
I hope it's a book everybody loves.
And come March 10th, we can all find out. That's when The Dangerous Shore will hit bookshelves all around the country. The author is Sarah Vladek. And we're going to dive a little deeper into these 600 pages when we come back. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a link to order your copy, or just search for The Dangerous Shore on Amazon. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our focus today, the upcoming book release, The Dangerous Shore by Sarah Vladek. If you read the New York Times bestseller, Indianapolis, you know how talented a writer she is and how exhaustive a researcher she is. We've got the link for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. The cover art for the book is actually Sarah's handiwork, too. And under that title, The Dangerous Shore, you'll find this synopsis: how a motley crew of scientists, mobsters, double agents, retirees, volunteer pilots, and a Boy Scout stopped the invasion of America. Sarah, I'm pretty confident that anybody reading this is going to learn a few things they never would have learned otherwise, because I'm pretty sure that was your experience too.
I think there's so much history in here that even as someone who studies history, I didn't know, but it's told in a way that is relatable to what's going on in the world today. And it's very much the everyday person's story, but it, you know, I'll say it, I've been told it reads like a thriller. It reads like spies. And the other thing too about it is it's written in present tense, which I've been told that's not done very often for World War II, but I wanted the reader to know what's happening in the moment it's happening. So we have, you know, the same advantage as the person living it of knowing what was happening then and making decisions, not in the rearview mirror and saying, I should have, but saying, this is all I have. This is all I know. What do I do right now? I think with that, everyone could read it and say, oh, I would have done this or I would have done that. And, you know, I think even in Indianapolis, when I put the reader in the shoes of the sailor, I wanted you to feel like you were walking the deck of that ship. In this case, I want you to walk the streets of New York as the mob is keeping Germans from landing. So it's not just a history lover's book. It's more of a, you know, personal stories lover book. And then the fact is you get to learn a lot of things about how we're kind of repeating history and should know a little better.
Ooh, I don't know if we want to go down that road with all the implications, but I think you're old enough to remember the make your own adventure books. Is that what they call them? And that's kind of what this is because of what you just said, the way you wrote it. So we're forced as a reader to say not only what's going to happen next, but what would I do? And all these people, as you said, are everyday people. So I just kind of have to ask, are there some moments where as you're writing it, you're saying, there's no way in the world I would ever do what that person did?
That's really hard. There's a lot of times I'd say, yes, absolutely. I'd like to believe I would not do that. Actually, yeah, the using the concentration camp labor for building the V2 rockets is one I'm pretty sure that I'd say no to. I also didn't live in Germany during the war and didn't have the you either do this or die situation. So again, what I really tried to do with this is there's no defined bad guy. There are humans. And there's certainly people you want to yell at in this book, and they made bad choices, right? But there are some instances where the Germans are the good guys, and you are in a U-boat as they're being bombarded by mines or whatnot, and they're 17-year-old kids who had absolutely no choice. They were conscripted, you know, into war, and they're afraid, you know, they had something like a 70% chance of not coming home. I don't know what that, I can't imagine what that's like, but making the decisions they did in that moment. But then you have, you know, the Americans aren't always the good guys. And you have, obviously, you do have a lot of Americans that are heroes, but choices were made. And I would like to think like, yeah, I'd always make the right choice. But one of the advantages or disadvantages of writing in present tense is you can only make the decision with the information you have in that moment. You don't get to say, well, I know the atomic bomb is coming in 6 months. You don't get to know the war's ending in a month. You have to decide with the technology, with the news. And, you know, 80 years ago, we did not have the information flow that we do now. So news spread much less quickly. And so I think about that, like trying to make a decision and put myself in a place of that level of technology. Computers didn't exist yet. They were just beginning. You know, the calculator was like, wow. So would I make those same choices knowing the same things, knowing it was my life or their life? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. So many things you've got me thinking about as we talk about that. You know, with your previous project and so much of your life's work with the Indianapolis, there's that obvious what if. What if the ship was sunk before it got to Tinian with the components of the atomic bomb, not afterwards? How different would the world be today? And this book has a few moments, I don't know if they're quite at that magnitude, but are similar, where it's the probability of something happening exactly the way it did has to be astronomical. But because it happened, the war went the way it went. Were there any moments in researching that where you're like, wait a second, that's unbelievable. I can't believe that this happened and this happened and this happened and that's why this happened.
There's a lot, actually. There's moments in there, especially with the technology of the bomb, the B-O-M-B-E bomb, which decoded, you know, German, the Enigma, the timing of when that worked and the timing of, so Joe Desch is the one who was behind the technology of that in Dayton, Ohio at the, you know, National Cash Register Company. For him to do that when Kenneth Knowles, the super nerd I had talked about before, came into play, all of those things had to happen at the exact time. We were losing. I mean, we were losing bad. We were getting spanked in the Atlantic. And had they not done those things at the time they did it, we could have lost then, you know. And if we had not broken that code, if we had not known how to maneuver around certain things, the war could have gone on longer. A lot of things could have changed, but it also was timed in with, you know, certain technology and certain advancements and the acquisition of the Enigma machine, you know, from one of the other, the German U-boats that we captured. That affected Normandy. Well, if Normandy didn't go the way it did, that would have completely changed the war in Europe. So all of these things, you know, that's a bigger example of how it happened. But it's wild to me to think that, like, it comes down to what, like, 3 or 4 people that could have changed the entire trajectory if the timing didn't work the way it did. And I don't think we realize, when we think of war, it seems like a big picture, or it seems like only the leaders are the ones that, you know, manipulate or move things the way they do. But it's like a handful of either people who did really good or really messed up and it changed everything that lead to the outcome.
Yeah, I have more World War II questions, but as you say that, I'm wondering if there's even a life application there for everybody. Has it made you examine your own choices and decisions and their impact because you've seen the scale of some of these 80 years ago?
It's very deep.
It's not the standard book tour question.
I think it just helps me to pause and look at, again, what's happening in the world today and, like, what we're seeing, what's being told to us, what is happening in the bigger picture, and what is my role? Like, what can I do in my world to make things better? And I think in this and Indianapolis too, both of them made me pause and say, what is my role in this? What is my worry in this? What is my trust? Like, my trust is in God first and in all things. And so to pause and to do that before I react irrationally, I would say, if anything, that might be the life application. And so I'm still learning that lesson all the time.
Aren't we all? I'm sure a lot of listeners out there said amen to that one. So now let me just get some context here. How long did it take to research and write The Dangerous Shore?
Well, in between when I started and when it, you know, became the book, COVID happened. And so that kind of slowed things down in the research capacity, because archives and meeting people. And unfortunately, we lost some of the people, the firsthand testimonies, the pilots passed away during that time. So that kind of prolonged it. But it was about 3 to 4 years of research and then 2 years of writing, along the way. And then I had finished, or I'd gotten very close to being done with a draft, and I had requested multiple redacted or censored files from the FBI and the Naval Intelligence. And I received them about 2 weeks before the book was due. And they changed everything. They totally changed everything. So then it was for 2 stories. One was the spy, the German saboteurs that landed. There's been a version of that story that's been told for 80 years, and the released files told a totally different story. And that's that I go into that in the book very deeply. And then the other was, I had mentioned before, with all the quotes that I have that are based on FBI surveillance, is the double agent spy, the woman, Grace, or she went by Graz, is how she would pronounce it. And they actually bugged and filmed her apartment 24/7 and had agents watching her 24/7 for over a year. And all of those transcripts came in. So I was something like 5,000 pages of transcripts I had to read to put in this, which was so much. And she is scandalous. Oh my gosh. And so I was like reading, I don't even know, like, I've never read anything like that. And a great story behind the scenes is that when all that came in and I thought I had to finish this like in 2 weeks to get it revised, I ended up getting more time. But my mother-in-law volunteered to like thumb through this stuff. And my mother-in-law is like the most wonderful woman and helper. And but she got all the like almost porn. And so I was like, I'm going to go hide under a rock. Like, you know, anyways, that's the part I accidentally gave her to read. And she gave it back and was like, oh, I don't think you're going to use this part. So anyways, all that to say is I had all this material and this new material. So I went back and took that and I wove it into the narrative. And so that took about another year to redo that and get it to be the book it is.
So this has been a gigantic labor of love for a long time. So I wanted people to know how much, work you'd put into that. But my biggest question that keeps coming back to me is, now that the book's actually out, did you answer more questions or create more questions? Like, are you left now with more questions than you had when you started out?
Well, to your point earlier, when you said, what else is out there? This really, really sparked that in that, like, what else still exists that we don't know? And what personal stories are families still saving, like, in their lockers or their, foot lockers or whatnot that they have preserved? Like, are they reading these stories? So that really sparked that question. It answered a lot. Like, I had no idea. I just really had no idea about the Battle of Atlantic the way I do now. So that really opened my eyes to that part of the war and to the home front. I think the home front is overlooked so much in war stories, and not just the aspect of keeping the spies at bay, but the resources that we had to generate and sacrifice, like down to people couldn't have nylons or couldn't have, kitchen mixers or couldn't have like everyday things that they would need, sugar, butter, oil, gasoline. Like, you were allowed to go 50 miles a week. And those were for the people who were given passes to commute. Like, that wasn't the everyday person. So all of these things I don't think we think about, or the fact that the labor that came forth or the resources that were needed to fight that war. And, we see the Rosie the Riveter, or we see these things here and there, but I don't think to the extent the sacrifice that were made by the people that stayed home, that that's ever talked about. So that made me have a million more questions, like, what other stories from the home front are there?
Well, and you've addressed a lot of them in this book, and that's just it. We hear the kind of the big picture of the home front, but just like the combat stories, the personal sacrifice, the personal impact is more powerful than that generalization. And you've captured so much of that in this book. Did thumbing through those 1,000 pages you got 2 weeks before your deadline, did that make you wonder how many other people had a 1,000-page file at the FBI archives?
Yes. I mean, there's, well, point in fact, looking for the two particular people that I was looking for, I'm seeing all these other names as I'm and they have, they have files at the FBI. They're not in the National Archives. They're still in the FBI. And some of the files I got for Grace Buchanan Dineen, who was the spy or double agent spy, had not been opened for 80 something years. So that was really neat to like kind of rediscover this story in the depth that I was able to. But there were, for every one Grace file, there was this FBI person of interest, this FBI person of interest. And I'm pretty sure like someday, I dream of my retirement being they just let me loose in the National Archives and I can go through all those boxes that have never been opened. And they talk, there's hundreds of boxes there that are still, they're filing, categorizing, whatnot. Like, drop me off there and I'll send my rocking chair and go through files.
I'm picturing the Indiana Jones treasure hunter kind of mentality as you pursued this project.
Yes, it felt like that. It felt like that with a lot of things, especially as, it started off as that little story about the Eagle 56, and it kind of, had its, we'll say, tentacles, for lack of a better word, that went into all these other little pieces of history. And I just felt like I was holding, these stories in my hands. In fact, actually, one of the things that I found at National Archives was, So there were 8 saboteurs that landed in Florida and New York, or Long Island, and their shovels and their equipment is still in a box and you can hold it. And it's so wild to me that that's at the National Archives, like those kind of things, like that's so cool. And I don't even know where I was going with this, but other than that was like one of the highlights was going into you said Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And it felt like the Indiana Jones locker or that big warehouse and where you're going through these boxes. And I was like, this is the shovel the spies used to like build or to hide their bombs on the beach in Long Island, what? And that's super cool.
So much to explore in The Dangerous Shore, Sarah Vladeck's upcoming sure to be bestseller that hits shelves on March the 10th. Again, you can pre-order your copy right now and stay tuned for updates on book signings that she may have near you in the months ahead. When we come back, more about this project, but also what historical quest we might see Sarah embark on in the future. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating conversation today with historian, filmmaker, and best-selling author Sarah Vladek. Her latest World War II project, The Dangerous Shore, debuts on March the 10th. You can pre-order the book now, and we have that link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. As we come down the home stretch here, Sarah, I want to take you back to something you mentioned earlier. It was the story of the USS Eagle that took you down this path, and that there wasn't enough on the USS Eagle to make itself its own, you know, thorough book. But in the course of putting this book together, is there something you stumbled across that's maybe incorporated into the book that you're like, you know, maybe that's my next book? Because there's a mushroom of tentacles that are coming from this little plot point here.
Maybe so. I mean, each one of them could have been their own book to some degree. You know, maybe Eagle not standalone, but certainly Grace Buchanan Dineen's story, the double agent spy, you know, the mob story. Those are all, you know, you could deep dive way into a rabbit hole on any of these and it would be a book. What I really want to do is take all this material and make it a long form television series. And then I can use all that material that I couldn't put in the book. I can use it in the TV show.
So if you're a television executive, you know who to talk to. And it's funny you said that because I was just about to ask you when you brought up Grace again. Seems like that would be a movie, just like her life, the complicated nature of everything she was doing. So I was going to ask you if you thought about a movie from any of this, but so your vision is a serial, a television serial that would flesh out not just what's in the book, but all the other things that ended up on your literary cutting room floor.
Yes, I think so. And I think in either a limited series, so like, you know, an 8-part kind of, not Band of Brothers, but something along those kind of lines, or a series, because it would be too much to fit into a 90-minute, 2-hour movie. There's this, well, I don't want to give away the spoiler alert for Grace, but let's just say she's like a Cruella de Vil looking character. She's got the fur, she's got the jewels, she's got the long cigarette that, you know, she's going and she's speaking to YMCA groups about the war effort in Europe and going without. And meanwhile, she's a spy for Germany. This is how this kind of all starts. And then, you know, so I think playing her as a character would be fabulous, you know. And then meanwhile, then she's teaching Catholic classes and then she's, you know, sleeping with 8 people. So she is quite the character, but then she ends up working for us and breaking apart this massive Detroit spy ring. That's, you know, because that's where our industry is with our planes and everything going on in that hub of industry. And these people are trying to sabotage it. And she's coming in her furs and her jewels. And she's speaking at like campgrounds in this attire.
And some people are hearing this and they're saying, Wait, I didn't realize there were enemy spies in the U.S. during World War II. But I'm thinking about all the prisoners of war I've interviewed over the years, and almost every single one of them, the ones that were held in Germany especially, they talk about that interrogation and the mind-blowing moment when the interrogator is telling them things about themselves that even they had forgotten. Like, the Germans had such a spy network within the U.S. that they had files on all these American servicemen who would end up as prisoners of war. Have you been able to, I know this is just kind of a sidebar to the book, but have you ever been able to evaluate or grasp the magnitude of the spy penetration domestically during World War II?
I hadn't before this, and throughout the time researching this, I really kind of got a grasp of that. But what's even more surprising to me was the Japanese infiltration. It was massive, and it was the second generation Japanese. Like, you know, their parents had come over, and these were the kids, and they were the ones that were giving our ship movement, our, you know, our resources, all that. They were reporting it back almost in real time. And we don't often hear that part of the story, but it was quite impressive what they accomplished with that amount of communication. That reading the transcripts of those, I came across all the CIA files that, you know, they were later converted to, or owned by, if you will, CIA. And there's thousands of transcriptions of all the, both the Germans and the Japanese, and the messages, and, you know, how much they actually caused damage or how much we prevented is hard to, you know, we don't know. We can't guess that. But to see the volumes of these documents and these messages, it's like, oh my gosh, like, they really were here. They were really, you know, trying to get that information back to the enemy.
And unfortunately, and you kind of alluded to earlier, this blurring of the lines between good and bad, because we all want to think everything anyone with a United States uniform did in World War II was great. And anything anyone wearing a Nazi uniform or a Japanese uniform was bad. And the truth is that that's never the case in any conflict. And what I've heard more of, especially from so many of our Nisei veterans, is, well, my parents were hauled off the day after December 7th. They were interrogated by the FBI. I didn't see my parents for 2 years. You know, obviously, they on the West Coast, they were kicked out of their homes. They lost everything their own. I mean, it was a tragic abuse of American citizens. But what you just hit on was, I think, key, because the context there. Because there were some people doing the bad thing, innocent people paid the price for them. I imagine that was hard for you to wrestle with, even in putting this together. How do you tell the difference between this person and that person?
Oh, it was incredibly difficult. In fact, there's a story, well, two parts. The first story was the Steinhoff brothers. So the Steinhoff brothers, Ernst Steinhoff, was one of the founding fathers, if you will, of NASA, but also created the V2 missile. And he was, you know, on the guidance system part of it, worked directly, was good friends with Wernher von Braun. And they're using the labor from concentration camps to build these missiles. And I spent quite a long time speaking to all the members of his family, his children, who in fact were there at Peenemünde while this was happening, and to see their perspective, and, you know, as the children of this person, and how much they loved their father and how great of a father he was. And what he was doing, and, you know, there's some argument too, he just wanted to work in this field, and the only way you could in Nazi Germany was to be a Nazi, you know, to join the club, if you will. And so, but then you have this father that kisses his children, every single one of them, on the head before he leaves for work every day, and he is religious, and he, you know, all these things, but then he's going and building a missile that's killing people, and then he comes back, and now he's a hero. In America, you know, he's part of the paperclip people that came over, and he's a hero. But I'm talking to the families of the Steinhoff brothers, and there's part of me that's like, I really, really want you to read this book, because I tried to give, you know, I tried to do an unbiased perspective. Like, this person lived in these shoes and did these things, right? But I'm still kind of like, but there's this dark side. And that's hard to navigate, to say it, because what I really tried to do in this was to write an unbiased, here's what happened. Dear reader, you decide, are they good or bad? Did they make the right choice? Did they make the wrong choice? What would you have done? And, you know, that came up a lot with different things, with how they treated the saboteurs and how, you know, what the result of Operation Pistorius was, and all these different things. Like, certain people made decisions, and sometimes they were good and sometimes they were very bad. So I, you know, it's a lot of playing God. I said that before, and I'm glad that we live in a very different time now.
and it may be that, you know, 80 years from now, we're still unfolding more context and looking at it through a different lens. So on that whole blurred lines thing, another thing that a lot of people don't know about World War II is that here in America, not only did, you know, we incarcerate 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry, we had German, Italian, Japanese prisoners of war being held on U.S. soil. And in some cases, some of those people helped defeat their homeland in ways that maybe they didn't anticipate.
Very much so. I mean, Fort Hunt is a great example. It's in near Washington, D.C., and that was a top secret. They called it like P.O. Box, I think it was 142 or something along those lines. And a lot of information came because that facility was built to, it was like bugged equivalent of that time. So they would give them swimming pools and they would give them recreational areas and they would all be bugged. So the defenses are down and they would talk about things and that would give us the intelligence we needed. Now, there was the darker side of it with the interrogations that, you know, for the most part, some groups like the Ritchie brothers and individuals who were responsible for getting that intelligence did it the right way, handled it well. It was done, you know, with integrity. And then there were the other examples, and I go really into that in the book, is people who didn't, who broke the Geneva Convention, who did, you know, they believe this, you know, New York is going to be attacked. Everyone, you know, toward the last few months of war, everyone thought New York was going to be bombed. And intelligence was supporting this. Spies that were captured were telling this. In those exact prison camps, Fort Hunt, for example, prisoners of war were giving supporting evidence to say this was going to happen. Well, when you introduce this threat that's now coming toward the United States, and we need to find out if they have the equipment and the capabilities to bomb New York, how far do you go? The question is, what is that line? And I don't know. I mean, I don't have the answer. In that moment, in present tense, in the time where you think that U-boat is coming for you, New York, any day, and you happen to have someone who was behind the invention of the submerged rocket test on the boat, or his brother, actually, how far do you go? And when is that justified? And I think, you know, those are the kind of questions I pose in the book, but I let the reader decide, based on all the evidence that's presented, was that the right choice, or did they go too far?
And as I hear you say that, I think I'm probably not the only one thinking, okay, if all these things were happening 80 years ago, what's happening today? How often in preparing this book did you have that, wait a second, what does it look like now?
So many times. I mean, little incidents to big incidents that are happening. And I think, what are we being told and what's actually happening behind the scenes? And how protected are we? I think there's a lot of times we don't even know how close we are to war or to even a small conflict that would change the way we live, right? In our everyday lives, or would interrupt our everyday lives. We don't know that. And so, you know, we all hope deep down, I think that I say this and then I kind of cringe as I say it, in whatever, in all of history, our government is the good guy, right? We hope. But seems like we, you know, and I'm not even talking about present time. I'm talking about big picture, all our leadership. We hope they make the right choices, that they're the good guy, but they're also human too. So I think they work with what they have and what they know, and maybe they're protecting us. But that came up so many times where I'm, you know, reading about the Nazi Bund parades in New York, where tens of thousands of people are going to these parades in celebration of Nazi Germany, and they're teaching Hitler Youth in America, and at camps, at youth summer camps, and things like that. We're like, wait a minute, like, that couldn't have happened. Well, it did. And what are we doing nowadays? Like, what are the things that, not as like Nazis, but what are we doing in this moment that 80 years from now, people are going to look back and be like, my gosh, they were idiots, or they didn't know. Like, we have this, you know, they'll have the advantage of the rearview mirror to look back upon, but we don't know right now. We're doing what we can do in the moment with the information we have, and hoping that what we're being told in the leadership is making the right choices that about what we get to know.
Yeah, and you brought up, you know, the German-American Bund and the penetration of those Nazi ideologies in America. And it's, that wasn't limited to the East Coast. I mean, right up in Los Angeles,
There was a home in Griffith Park that was supposed to be Hitler's world headquarters because some sympathizers here had purchased it for him. And there have been some of those dystopian, you know, what if novels written if Hitler had won the war, if things had been different. But were there any, like, just giant screaming five alarm what ifs for you in putting this book together that you said, if that didn't go just the way it did, maybe I'm not even here to be writing this book right now?
One of the interesting things that was discovered in this whole process was how connected my family and my husband's family were to this story. And it was, you know, in the 11th hour finding these things out. But my stepfather, he lived in Maine, and his dad had sinking a ship right off his coast, was right there. And he was a 10-year-old and seeing, you know, the oil wash up on the sand and all these things. And turns out that his family rented, they called them casitas, you know, rented a casita to the brother of Kenneth Knowles, who was the head of his brother was head of DuPont and the making of neoprene and the certain aspects of, you know, war industry that DuPont was responsible for. And so they, you know, he was the same age as the son who witnessed the U-boat sinking the ship on their boat. And so that was one kind of just crazy that happened to be, you know, brought forth. But the other one was that, where do I start? How do I tell this story? So my husband, Ben, his grandfather was on the Frederick C. Davis. And the Frederick C. Davis was the last ship sunk in the Atlantic by U-boats. There was another ship sunk like within an hour, which was the Eagle. That was sunk in American coastal water. So the Frederick C. Davis was sunk by a captain by the name of Paul Yeust. And Paul Yeust was in the POW or the prison cell after he was captured. So he sunk the Davis and then we captured and sunk his U-boat. And he was brought to prison to be interrogated. And he was in the jail cell next to Steinhoff, who was captured and who was the one who knew about the submerged rocket attacks on New York. So turns out after the war, Ben's grandpa became friends with Captain Paul Yeust, who sunk his ship. And they, Ben and his family, grew up hearing stories about what really happened in the POW camps. And so it was kind of wild to have all these story connections actually be connected to my family. So they have notes from Paul Yeust, and they have pictures of sitting on his lap and hearing U-boat stories and all these things going on. And that helped me actually unravel what happened with Friedrich Steinhoff, the U-boat captain, brother to the guy who created the V-2. Those two did the missile test together, but that helped me unravel his, quote, suicide, which didn't really turn out to be a suicide after all. So that's been a mystery that, you know, spoiler alert, I guess, but I got to put together those pieces because of my husband's family connections to the story.
See, it just goes to prove again, if you start down that path and you work long enough, you're going to find a connection.
Somehow.
It's connected to you somehow. And so many people out there are thinking about what connections they might have. And I don't think you have to worry about spoiler alerts. I think everybody is convinced they need to buy The Dangerous Shore. But I need to ask you, Sarah, what do you want people to take away from this book? I know you talked about putting them in the shoes of these historical characters. What decisions would they make? But is there a theme that it left you with, or an understanding, or just a message in this book that you hope readers might digest?
I hope that readers find a little bit of themselves in at least one of these characters and see that when we're called to do the right thing, that we stand up and we do it. And it might not be the easy path, but it's the right path. And every one of these characters could have given you a million reasons why they quit when they, you know, when it got really, really hard. And some characters, man, the things they faced were just incredible that they overcame them and kept going. From nervous breakdowns to like marriages ending to all these different things, like they fought through it because it was the right thing to do for the bigger picture. And my hope is that the characters and the people are relatable enough in that they were so ordinary that we too can be extraordinary like they were when called to do it.
You know, so often when someone's writing a bestseller, especially in the fiction space, well, how do I get this reaction? How do I make this more exciting? How do I suck them in and then bring the payoff? And I know that's not what you're doing here, even if it has some of those flavors at times. How much responsibility did you feel because of the uniqueness, the gravity, and the historic value
of all these documents and artifacts that you're browsing through in all your years of research?
I honestly think it was a privilege. I think that being a caretaker for stories, because I believe that's what nonfiction writers are, is they're caretakers for a legacy, that what a cool job, you know, to have that responsibility and to really genuinely look at all the facts and say, you know, glean 2 pages from 5,000 or whatever it is, you know, to say, this is the heart of it. And here, let me present it to you in a way that you can read it and understand it and care about it too. Like, that feels to me like the greatest privilege to be able to do that and to hold those notes that were handwritten by people, whether they were letters home, whether they were a diary, or whether they were the crazy ramblings of J. Edgar Hoover, who was just not a good dude. So to have these things and to hold these pieces of history that were held by the same people who lived it, and to carry that forward and to share that with people, there's just no better way to say it than it's a privilege. And I feel like that was a gift that God has given me in writing these stories, is that here's the information and let me help you guide it to in a way that people can read it and enjoy it and have fun with it. And like, it almost is fiction. It's written like it's fiction, but 100% of it is true and based on quotes and papers and actual testimonies of those who lived it.
So I just have one more question. And maybe it's not fair because you've been working all these years and the book's not even on shelves yet, but it will be soon. The Danger is Sure. You can order it right now. I have to ask, what's next? Because as I've known you for a while and I've seen your career progress, your calling, I guess I would say, progress, it seems like everything leads into something else. So do you have any feeling yet? Can you give us a little tease on what genre, topic, or storyline you might be exploring next?
Well, you know, I started with 2 very small topics, I say jokingly. There's been some ideas presented to me that seem interesting, dealing with, you know, NASA and the history of space and all that. But I think the next one is going to be the Bible, is going to be going into that, and not the Bible itself, but all the caretakers of history who kept the letters, the scrolls, the antiquities, all these things, who were the caretakers through these thousands of years, and what is their story? So we'll see, but that's kind of the next step, where I'm probably just going to go write a couple screenplays just so I can do something easy for a while.
Yeah, I think the Bible Project is a little more substantial than anything you could possibly do. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for telling us about the book. I hope everyone's going to order a copy or 2 or 3. Anything else that you want to share?
I think I got it. I'm going to take a nap now.
Yeah. After all those years of research, she deserves one, doesn't she? Once more, the new book is called The Danger is Sure. You can find it at Amazon.com or many other platforms. It's available for pre-order now, and I've ordered a few already because I have some friends in mind I know are really going to love it. It's also a great way to support Sarah's efforts, her heart for veterans, and her dedication and determination to dig down to real answers that otherwise would remain shrouded in mystery. Well, that's something that I would say has impressed and inspired me over the years. So thanks again to Sarah and her husband, Ben, and thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.